and welcome back to what can probably at this stage be considered the world's most infrequent podcast. Apologies for our absence. We'd ideally like to do this every week if we could, wouldn't we, Ray? But
I mean, in our defence, we're not professional YouTubers. We're not monetized. We've got no plans to be. And we've got a living to earn, so that's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it.
It's all very well talking about motorcycles. We're supposed to be working on motorcycles generally, but it's always nice to get the time to get in the studio when we are able to. Something I must mention first off is that we were recently featured in an article, a blog post, by Emma Henry at WeBuyAnyBike.com. The link to the blog is webuyanybike.com/blog/6-podcasts-bikers. The post is indeed titled Six Podcasts for Bikers. And about us, they said, this occasional podcast, that's an awfully kind way of putting it, occasional podcast is hosted by Ray and Rowan. Together they bring you all the tips and tricks in restoring classic motorcycles. So there we go. Many thanks to Emma Henry for that.
Thanks for the mention.
It's funny because we've been saying, oh, must get back in the studio, must record some more. And then that article came through, so we're like, right, we've got to do it now. So do check out webuyanybike.com, even if you're not in a position where you're looking to sell a motorcycle. There's lots of interesting articles and things on there. So thanks again, and check them out. Also, a bit of housekeeping. We were talking some while ago. Somebody had asked us about putting up the older episodes of the podcast back on iTunes. We had every intention of doing so, but I soon realized that was not as easy as I thought it was. Basically, there's a free version and a paid version of the people we're using to host the podcast, and I thought, oh, well, if we do the paid version, which we're happy to do, then that will allow us to upload everything, but it was more limiting than I thought it was. So we'll keep looking at that. But if anybody has any suggestions in that regard, by all means, get in touch. Now, before we get on to this week's topic, which is refinishing, if I haven't mentioned already, you'll have seen by the title anyway, so I don't know why anybody feels the need to mention it, but there we go. Last week, spoke to our dear friend Bill Nelson. And he was recently in touch with us. He sent us a flyer for a BSA Owners Club event. So we thought he came on the podcast. Let's return the favor by mentioning this. There's going to be some visual accompaniments with this episode today as we are talking about refinishing. So we'll try not to allude to things too much for the purposes of it being still listenable if you are just listening. But you should see a picture of that flyer somewhere here now, but I will read it anyway for the audio listener. This is the BSA Owners Club Open Day. It is on Sunday, the 26th of May, 2019. It says here, all bikes welcome, free entry. And that's at the Market Harbour Rugby Club. The postcode is LE169HF. That's Lima Echo 169 Hotel Foxtrot. Having a father who was formerly a Metropolitan Police officer, one tends to pick up the phonetic alphabet. There's a £5 discount for new members on the day. And it says here, along with a very nice picture of an oil and frame A65. I like the dove grey frame. Do you not?
I don't think there was ever any difficulty with it cosmetically in appearance. But of course, it didn't last looking very nice for very long. And I think, and when it does start to deteriorate, it looks horrible.
Lovely picture, though. We had a single-cylinder machine coming fairly recently with that frame, didn't we?
Yeah.
It says here, celebrate the oil and frame range and buy raffle tickets to win our own oil and frame Thunderbolt. And then there's more about ticket prices, etc. And there is the BSA Owners Club website, bsaownersclub.co.uk, and some postal information there. So check that out if you're interested. Do go along. So let's talk a bit of feedback from the previous episode. A gentleman called John Butler chimed in on YouTube, first saying that Ray reminds me of Bill Bailey.
Okay, so I've somehow gone from, it was the snooker player, Steve Davis.
Yes, as a young man.
I was quite a close appearance to Steve Davis in my 20s, and now Bill Bailey. Okay, I'll live with it.
I don't know which is better. I know who I'd rather hang out with.
Well, okay, yeah,
But he also chimed in with something relating to, and this wasn't even last episode, this was the one before, because we knew we wouldn't have time before, but there we go. So, thank you, John Butler, for patiently awaiting a response from us. I will reply to you in the comments and say, oi, we talked about this again. He says, left-handed twist drills are an incredible aid in removing broken bolts slash studs. I wholeheartedly recommend... I'm wearing these teeth in for a friend. Oh, that's a retro gag, isn't it? I wholeheartedly recommend them. You will wonder how you managed without them. Raymond.
Well, I've got to be fair. I thought it was a wind-up, and how I've spent all these years in the workshop and not even realising that left-hand twist drills was a thing... I went looking and found some, and I can see that in terms of drilling out broken off studs and the like, they are likely to be of utility at different levels. And the main one, of course, is there's always the chance, as you're drilling out the broken stud, that it might sort of, the drill might sort of momentarily seize in the stud and take it out for you, so you don't have to drill all the way. The only problem is, having found some drills, I then didn't have an actual drill that went left hand.
Yeah.
Other than
you can believe it.
Other than the little battery ones, which, you know, just don't have the clout. So I managed to get one of those as well, one with a nice powerful motor and a nice controlled start. Otherwise, you've got the drill jumping off the broken stud as you start it up. But in the process, I found something... I think potentially, and bearing in mind since we were told about left-hand drills and the like and discovered all this new kit, we haven't actually had to use them. But it's this apparently is from the carpentry trade. It's a drill encased in a body with a sprung-loaded tip. Now, this is actually apparently for drilling holes to put hinges on a doorpost and on a door. In a domestic environment.
Are we branching out? Am I going to have to learn to do doors now?
No, I don't think so. And the idea is that this outer sleeve registers in the hole of the hinge.
Let me move that a bit closer. I don't know how to work it.
just pull the sleeve down.
See, I've not had to do this yet, pulling sleeve down. Yeah. Oh, yes, I see.
So in the same way as that perfectly synchronises the drill assembly with the hole in the hinge, I could see it doing exactly the same once, and the bits are interchangeable, so we could again put a left-hand twist drill in there as well. That would engage in the hole that the broken-off stud's in, and so you've got you'll be able to drill perfectly central. That's the theory. Looking forward to trying it.
Yeah. We may get comments saying, I've been doing that for years.
Yeah, I know.
It's when we first got into...
ultrasonic, are you
Yeah, absolutely.
Say,
yeah. You got on an ultrasonic tank. Think, oh, we really
what a good idea.
Get one of these. This is some years ago now. But
turns out everybody...
Everybody we told about. Well, like, we've got an ultrasonic tank. They're like, yeah, so have I.
Mind you, I think ours is bigger than most.
Yeah, well, which one?
Well,
before we have two of them now, which we'll come on to in a minute, actually. So, influences for why are we doing refinishing? Well, first off, we did some while ago have an email from a gentleman called Thomas, which I talked about at the time, but just to read it again, he says... One topic I was thinking you guys might discuss or dedicate a whole episode to in the future, if you felt it worthy, might be parts restoration. How you guys go about blasting, buffing, painting, etc. old parts during a restoration. I have no doubt you and your father's combined knowledge on the topic would give all of us listeners a helping hand dealing with all of our crusty bike projects. Yes, indeed, we saw that and we thought, yes, must do that. And that was brought further to the forefront of our mind when Bill Nelson, a man who's seemingly getting a lot of mentions here today, linked us to a post somebody had included in the I Know Bugger All forums, which Bill talks about at some length in the episode in question. I will read it here. This gentleman's called Mark, and he says, a few months ago, I bought a sound petrol tank for the B31/33. The current one is fine, all chrome, but not the right profile for my telly/rigid one. The buff logbook says that the bike had an apple green tank, which was probably light Brunswick green, according to knowledgeable people on the BSI Owners Club forum. This immediately made me think of another user's B33, which I always thought looked just right. So I asked him for some photos of his tank so I could get the painter to copy that. So, thanks to Gary the Painter and RJM of Alzi, who did the masking for the pinstripes, I've got a lovely shiny petrol tank and a chrome one to put on eBay. After filling a few dents, the tank was first sprayed gold, then the pinstripes were masked over and the tank painted green and then lacquered. I'm very pleased with the results. So, I will include some pictures of that. And Raymond, if you can remember that far back, it was a few months ago now, what do you remember of doing that job?
Well, it was a fairly, fairly standard lining for a paint scheme. Perhaps the thing that came as a bit of a surprise to the owner was that I wanted the final version of the tank furniture, so in other words, badges, knee grips, backing plates, etc., to actually fit to the tank once the gold had been laid down, so that I could reference my masking lines relative to the furniture that was actually going to be used. I say the actual furniture that was going to be used, because so often, for example, and particularly with Triumph, with the mouth organ, the early eyebrow and the late eyebrow badges, there are so many different versions of those that differ slightly, so that if you, for example, referenced off the tank badges, the old tank badges, when you got it all painted and fitted the new tank badges, they may not index correctly at all. And I've seen a few examples of that out in the wild that just look tragic. Whatever people may say about physically measuring where you're going to start and finish the lines, and applying the same measurements to both sides of the tanks, it's worth remembering, and particularly with a tank going back to this period, the actual press tools that made the two halves of the tank typically were handmade. And so you don't get a perfectly symmetrical tank. So if you applied one set of measurements to one side and then tried to apply the same to the other, one would look way better than another. So you can only do it by eye, and it's not the sort of thing you can just, you know, lay down the lines and quickly get it right. Sometimes you do have to mess about with it, get the best compromise of how it looks in a given direction. It's a bit of an art form rather than a technical operation, but there we are. You put the masking down, and then the main tank colour can be applied, and if you've got it right, you'll peel off the lining and you'll have perfect coach lines.
What's the reason for doing it that way rather than how I imagine it possibly would have been done originally? Would a tank have been painted and then the lines have been hand brushed on?
I mean, typically all the hand lining, all the lining was done by hand. Very often it was in the factory. It was a job that the ladies did, remembering that, you know, they are doing many hundreds of tanks of the same shape every day, so they get to practice. Now, the fact of the matter is, and somebody will no doubt shoot me down in flames at some point when I say that there just don't seem to be the skills these days to be able to do it in the traditional way. And moreover, of course, because it's a synthetic enamel that's used, it's not particularly hard wearing. So what start off as, if you're lucky, near perfect coach lines, just your knees rubbing on them for, you know, a few thousand miles, will tend to rub the coach lining away. So one, it's to achieve accuracy of lining where that talent doesn't widely exist, and two, it's to achieve a much more durable finish.
Then again, if you are someone who is able to do that accurately and durably, feel free to chip in the comments.
Well, make yourself known and we'll do you an advert. It's no skin off our nose, trust me.
Because it's not really – I mean, I remember when Mark walked through the door with the tank, and obviously he was a friend of a friend, and you don't want to turn anybody away, but it's not the sort of job we readily be
– it's not the sort of job we generally do as a standalone item, period, but, you know, to help out. We sometimes get involved in these things, and it was an interesting illustrative exercise to be able to add to a podcast.
And of course, he was a very nice chap who was very grateful for what you did. So
and it turned out super. Yeah, I mean, you know, nice jobs for nice people are easy. Nasty jobs for nice people, we're still happy to do. I'll leave the rest of your imagination.
Well, not that we've had too many of those for a long old while.
No, decades, actually.
But there you go. And if you see the paint on that tank and you like the look of that paint, the gentleman who does, I'm saying gentleman a lot today, awfully formal, who does our paint, you can, if you're local to us, you can get in touch with him at gpmotorbodyrepairs@gmail.com. He was, for the longest time, the painter for the car body shop that was on our industrial estate.
And who we used to use for all our paintwork. As I say, fortunately, he's gone self-employed, and we stay in touch and are able to have the use of a continuous skill.
Who is it you used to, not planned on discussing this, who is it you used to work for who used to say, language warning, if you can piss, you can paint? Not entirely fair.
Well, certainly the person who said it may well still be alive and may still be watching us. That's not a problem. It was my former boss at a firm that now no longer exists, which was Watkins & Biggleswade, and dear old Robin Watkin, who ran the body repair shop and the mechanical workshops. He had... a less than admiring view of painters in general.
So let's jump right in. Jump right in, he says, 15 minutes in. Being very critical of myself today. Let's move on to the meat of the discussion. You will have seen that fuel tank was, of course, media blasted first. And if we're talking about refinishing, blasting and painting is obviously a big part of that. It's always good fun when you're media blasting a fuel tank, and you're presented with a spectrum of colours as you blast through the paint. So I've had many, as I'm sure you have as well, Ray, many situations where a fuel tank comes in, it's blue, you start blasting it, it goes to red, then black, then green, then back to blue again. So that's all good fun.
The strange thing is I don't think I've, in 30-odd years, I don't think I've ever had a tank that you could refinish over the old finish, because for some reason, by the time they get to us... you know, each coat of paint is painted on an unstable substrate, i.e. the previous coat, and you just, everyone that's ever come to me, I've had to blast right the way back to bare metal.
And it's great to have the facilities to do it. Media blasting is, I would say, over and above everything else, the best way of removing paint. However, it's not that easy when it comes to powder coating, is it, Raymond?
Oh, no, it's awful. I'm sure, and again, there will be somebody locally who will throw me under the bus and say, well, we at X, Y, Z have got exactly the right set of chemicals in the right tanks to strip that off as quick as ninepence. And I say again, if you are that person, make yourself bloody well known to us, and we might put some business your way. But for us, it's mostly about paint stripper and a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I mean it's doable. It's not particularly enjoyable to do, but you know that's our stance with powder coating. I mean, it's funny really, because it at the same time manages to be difficult to get off and not particularly durable. We've seen many examples over the year of something that's been powder coated and it's just flaking off. Not too many
and
years
the rust
later.
Can creep underneath, yes, it without you knowing it, damaging the frame or whatever it turns out to be. And let's be fair, it's done because it's quick and cheap to do, and readily foolproof as well. But it you know, even if it is not compromised mechanically, so in other words, letting water and rust to develop, it very, very quickly becomes compromised cosmetically. Now, on things like, for example, T140 frames, you know, the thought of having to blast off powder coating, or even actually for that matter, chemically strip it, leaves you with big fat question marks about what sort of junk is migrating into the void in the frame, which is the oil tank. And we've seen the consequences of this on a number of occasions where motors have been badly compromised because it wasn't physically possible to get all of that media out of the frame. So what does one do? And particularly against a background of, you know, the essential powder coat being, you know, still quite sound, but just looking bloody awful. And we developed a technique to deal with that as well.
Indeed. Now, in terms of powder coating, sure, plenty of people disagree with us. By all means, have your stuff powder coated. But there is one thing that we must insist is not powder coated, and that is cylinder barrels. Right, Raymond?
Well, yes. And in fact, when I took a barrel over to T&L that had been powder coated, and they've got a small little plant that they can get rid of powder coating on relatively small stuff. I think it's just a bucket with the right kind of acid in. Barry was a little concerned as to, or a little perplexed as to why I wanted it removed. And I said, we've seen so many examples of powder-coated barrels where they've not been able to shed the heat, because principally it's like putting a hot water jacket around something that is designed to get rid of heat fairly quickly. So it can't. And we've seen any number of examples of bores that have become compromised because they've swollen up as the heat fails to part company with the item, and the bores themselves get all, as Jack would say, contwisted and contorted, and you get odd patterns of wear, you get premature wear, you get seizures, etc., etc. So if we're faced at any time with a barrel with powder coating on, that powder coating has to go as a minimum. And I even found in with a 5TA project some time ago, even found a motor with a barrel that had been powder coated on the outside and the inside, and somehow they'd managed to fit it and run the motor as well.
That's the thing. How do you get it? Do you even get that on with the thickness of powder coating?
And how do you? Do you not understand? That's
maybe,
not the
maybe
way.
It was really in need of a rebore.
Do you know what?
That was the intention.
I've really no idea, but it was the funniest thing I'd seen in a long time at that point.
So you were talking there as a final note on powder coating, and you touched on oil bearing frames.
Yeah.
How even if you did blast them, you would worry about contamination.
Yeah. What I now do, and this sounds. This sounds a bit like amateur hour, but don't worry.
I've included pictures for.
We researched it and we practiced it long before we offered it to a client as an option. Where the powder coating mechanically is sound, and the adhesion is good to the substrate, I literally flat it by hand, just to key it for another coat of paint on top of the powder coating. And actually brush paint it with a very high quality coach enamel, and find it gives a really quite superior finish.
Indeed. As a final note on the subject of painting for now, we recently had a client who wanted a finish which somewhat differs from what you would expect on his fork sliders and swinging arm.
Yep. He wanted them chrome plated.
Indeed.
The practicality of doing that, first of all, the fork sliders, there is absolutely no guaranteed way of not adversely affecting the inside of the fork slider. Also, of course, if you're chroming the thing, you're going to put the threads where the fork seal holders goes onto the slider. You're going to build up material there as well. And bearing in mind on a lot of Triumphs and BSAs, it's actually quite a big diameter but quite a fine thread. You're building up problems for yourself again there.
That's always a nightmare, even if you aren't chrome plating things. Quick bit of advice, you get new seal holders, try them on the sliders first.
Yeah, and if they don't fit, send them back. Again, in terms of the swinging arm, now whether the swinging arm has been previously chrome plated or not, the same problems really apply. Unless you get an absolutely pristine swinging arm that requires no that has no chrome on and requires no acid dipping to get rid of an old plated surface, and you can just lightly blast the sort of thin coat of synthetic paint that would have been applied by the factory by dipping, incidentally, then the actual stripping process can remove up to a third of the thickness of the material. And, you know, if it's got rust pits here and there, you may need to go even deeper to get it perfectly polished before then applying the plate. And again, you know, it may look very pretty in the short term, but you are building up trouble for yourself all along. And if, say, for example, the tubes take in any of the stripping media, then you've potentially got a swinging arm that's rotting from the inside out from day one. So, you know, if for whatever reason you think this, you know, may enhance the appearance of the bike, I don't recommend it.
Nevertheless, what did we do? We told him to get stuffed. No, we didn't.
No, we decided to, you know, again, like all of these things, you suddenly find, like the left-hand drills, that things are available that courtesy of the internet that you would never have known about. And it appears that there are various versions of something called chrome plate.
Chrome paint.
It's a bit, and I thought, again, it was another wind-up because it was like the checkered paint out of the tin.
Yeah. Tartan paint, bubbles for spirit levels, sparks for the arc welder.
And I don't know necessarily that we've used the very best product available, but it was an experiment worth having, particularly on this client's fork sliders.
She was happy. We spoke to him and said,
told him what we told you. And to be fair, the finished result looks a lot softer than actual chrome. It doesn't have the sharpness of chrome, and I would say it's more has the appearance of a polished alloy fork slider. Than a chrome steel one. But nonetheless, in taking every care to, because again, there was quite a lot of rust pits, and of course, unlike re-chroming, where you've got to bring everything down to the level of the bottom of the rust pits, with using a paint finish in this way, you can actually build up the rust pits to meet the original surface of the rest of it, literally by, you know, a relatively high build primer and putting a guide coat and flatting the guide coat by hand until it disappears, which then guarantees that you've got rid of all the rust bits. And I have to say, I was very impressed with the finish. So
yeah, I think it's close enough. It's a worthy compromise, and obviously thanks to John for being a guinea pig.
Yes,
regard.
That's the one.
And he was happy with the finish as well. So there you go. Which just on the advertising front goes to show how important it is to keep in constant communication. So you know what we're doing, and we know what you want us to do. But there we go. So, media blasting we talked about, but you don't always media blast in preparation for painting. There's various kinds of media that people use in terms of walnut shells and plastic beads.
Ground up toilet seats was one I heard of as well. Apparently it's a thing.
Recycling. Yeah. As they say, the possibilities are endless. and vapor blasting. There's a lot of people use vapor blasting. We've always dry blasted with glass.
Well, because a lot of the stuff we're blasting is actually steel and wouldn't look very good. It'd need blasting again by a dry blast, aren't
you? Yes, indeed. So that's 90% of the time that's a cylinder head or perhaps a rocker cover we're doing that on. But tell us a bit about that process, Ray.
Well, it's the process we use and the products that we use, our scheme is peculiar to ourselves. Because we've developed something that works for us. First of all, we're blasting with an expendable media, which I understand is based on copper slag. Now, it's a disposable media. It's only intended to go through the gun once, but actually will go through many times before it becomes too tired and too contaminated. And even when when the media starts to break up, it remains quite sharp. So it remains serviceable for a lot longer than you would think. But the point is, it's sharp, so we can blast at relatively low pressures and still get a good clean result. And then we finish off with medium glass bead, and it gives a lovely sheen and a dirt repellent surface that will stay that clean and that silky for many years.
One thing we don't generally use that for, and we have done once or twice in the past where we've been asked to, is we don't like to media blast crankcases, do we, Ray? Why is that?
No, well, I have an objection on two fronts. One, so many we've seen where this has been done. The motor has had a relatively short existence before lots of clanking and knocking and goodness knows what occurs. And it's at that point that somebody realises that you know, they hadn't properly purged the cases of all the wayward media, blasting media. And I remember, and I'll try not to chuck anybody under the bus here, but it serves as a good warning. One of the first Lightning Clubmans that were A65 that ever saw public eye in terms of an article in Classic Bike magazine, and which was the first time we understood what a Lightning Clubman was. Some number of years later, we were approached to rebuild the motor on this. It was actually featured in Classic Bike magazine. And it turned out what we found in the bottom of the engine was about a teacup full of coarse grinding paste, which had clearly wreaked havoc around the inside of the motor. The other thing is, I think it gives a very artificial look to crankcases, because, you know, clearly something's been done to them other than what was done at the factory. So you don't get a convincing looking casting as a result. You get one that's been very much sanitized and in a sense detailed as well. My personal opinion is they just look lifeless. They look like a dinky toy, basically. And I find by literally just cleaning the cases, it looks so much more real when the motor goes back together.
Yeah, I mean, what we generally do, and this goes back to ultrasonic cleaning, is you get off the worst you can through scraping and hand wire brushing, etc., which you'd have to do anyway if you were media blasting, because if you've got something that's really caked in mud, and boy, have we had a couple recently, it's what you get when a machine is tended for off-road use, and then it comes to see us after it's lived a life. There we go. Scrape off what you can, brush off what you can, and then we usually finish off with a couple of hours in the ultrasonic tank, and then usually pressure wash and blow off with compressed air at the end. That's generally
To be fair, there are, what should we say, people who do nothing but rebuild predominantly car engines and the like for a living. You know, have usually got a huge, great machine that will, you know, like a pressure cooker. You know, half an hour at regulo 9 and the job's done. We're not doing it with that level of frequency, and we're not dealing with bits that large. As awesome a process as it is, we don't need to go that route. But there are people who use that sort of equipment that can be very, very aggressive. And I have to say the results are very often quite impressive.
Another thing people sometimes do with crankcases is have them machine polished. What's your stance on that?
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, machine polished, hand polished, whatever. The very first A65 cafe racer that I ever built, I spent a lot of time polishing bits of the crankcases, but then found out the first time I got it on the road what a mistake it was, because, you know, you are effectively reducing the surface area of those cases by probably 50%. And thereby reducing its ability to dissipate heat by the same amount. So if you do either hand polish or machine polish crankcases, don't be entirely surprised if that motor always runs too warm.
We have nothing against machine polishing, though. It's something that we do a lot of, as you can imagine. And it's nice to be working with basically everything we're involved with, because these things, first time round, weren't really built down to quite the cost that Japanese stuff was. Components are generally more durable, and say an outer primary cover is a perfect example. 50-60 years later, you'll still be able to polish that, and the thickness of the material is such that you can polish again and again, and even if there is some dents in there. Now, if something's really severe, as we've discussed before, Ray, you're sometimes better off minimizing rather than eliminating altogether due to the strength it will cause the cover to be.
I think as far as over polishing, and first of all, let me say, don't bring us your cases to polish. If we're working on a bike and restoring a bike, we will polish those cases. We will not do them as a standalone item. We've literally got better things to be doing.
But well, and really, there are people who specialise in doing just machine polishing, so why should we...
Exactly that. But what I was going to go on to say with that is that, you know, I mean, and our local plating works, Vehicle and General Polishers and Platers, you take a primary case or a timing cover to them, the job they will do for you will be absolutely the mutt's nuts. But remember that their primary objective is a perfect finish. Our primary objective is as near perfect a finish as we can achieve without it actually compromising the mechanical strength of the item. As Sazran says, if we've got one where, you know, there's some areas of damage, you may not attempt to get every single mark out. What we're looking to do is to not polish finely where we don't need to or where it would be inadvisable, but leave the component looking as perfect as we can from the normal observable distance. So in other words, underneath the casing, which is not normally viewed, we won't spend quite as much time polishing as we will trying to get the perfect finish on the bits that can be seen. So that's worth bearing in mind.
Although sometimes you do have to, because a lot of this stuff towards the bottom wouldn't have been machine polished anyway, so there is a rougher finish. This was a gearbox outer cover on an early 50s Matchless G3 I was doing the other day, and it was interesting to see. I don't think it had ever been re-machine polished before, and it was interesting. There's a section of it that has a more rough finish because it hasn't been polished, so in that situation there's no need to polish it. But generally where something has been polished before, there you kind of have to do so again. But we're sounding possibly negative in terms of the finish that's achievable. The situations where there's some real nasty dents in there, that's in terms of percentages, that's very small. And obviously, as you'll see with the pictures that are included, the achievable results with something that is, you know, triple my age or a bit more at times. I remember I showed a friend of mine once. I said, he was very complimentary. I said, well, it's nice what standards are achievable with, you know, 50, 60-year-old components. He said, I hope I look that good when I'm in my 60s. But when you were first teaching me to machine polish, Ray.
You never thought you were going to be able to do it, did you?
No, I didn't have a great level of confidence with it. And interestingly enough, there are certain jobs that you can do in the evening and you can come back and look at it in the morning and you go, oh, you know, I'm not sure I'm happy with that. Machine polishing, it's the complete opposite. You can, at the end of the day, finish the machine polishing and you go, oh, you know what, I think I might go back and do a little bit more on this tomorrow. Because you've been looking at those fine scratches.
Over-concentrating.
In such detail. Yeah. You come to it the next morning. You go, what am I concerned about?
What was ever wrong with that?
So that's quite rewarding. But I did struggle with machine polishing initially. So I had a look online. I thought, let's see if there's any processes that or any tips and tricks that should make life easier. And this was 6 or 7 years ago now, so things may be different now, but there was a bit of a dearth of that kind of thing. What I did find was from a company that was producing polishing equipment using the head of a hammer as a test piece, and the chap saying, right, we're going to polish this to a mirror finish. And by the end of it, yes, it was quite shiny, but it was still full of a lot of deep scratches and a lot of deep pitting, which is why the arguably the most important step of the polishing process is actually the scratch removal. And how do we achieve that, Ray?
And it's something that fascinated me really from hobbyist days, because as you can imagine, being a bit of a fan of cafe racers, which very often sported a lot of polished aluminium, and embarking upon building myself something of that kind for myself, I'm thinking, well, that's an awful lot of aluminium to polish in the beginning by hand, and an awful lot to keep looking smart once you've got it where it needs to be. So I was, you know, sucking up information about the subject all the while. So what we've ended up with is, again, like with our blasting process, you know, we've got a system that works for us. And literally it's based on, you know, cotton mops on a bench grinder type affair. We've actually got quite a powerful, quite a reliable one, which I bought certainly 20 years ago. And it must have been before the Iron Curtain was lifted, because the nation of manufacture on it is the German Democratic Republic. I mean, it is. It's built like a It's built like a Russian tank. You'd have trouble is if you're using something too low powered, or if you're trying to use miniature cotton mops on a hand drill, it just doesn't have the power, because you need a certain amount of oomph or a certain amount of horsepower to take a lot of pressure without stopping the polishing wheel to actually get the heat into the polishing soap and move it around the bit you're working on. We've got basically six inch diameter, 1.5 or 2 inch wide cotton mops, which are variously loaded either with an adhesive grit. You literally apply the adhesive and then let that tack off, and then apply just like with a bar of polishing soap. Just literally apply the grit to the wheel. Comes in various grades. We tend to use 180 most of the time. And you tend to, where you want a progressively finer finish, you tend to then switch to a mop that's been used fairly heavily. So you are actually applying a softer media to it, and then move on to wax grit soaps of various grit levels that you then just apply intermittently as you're polishing the item. That's how we do it, and usually with a final hand polish and de-soap, because obviously the polishing soap is a solid wax bar, and you tend to get an awful lot of that wax still stuck on the in the screw holes and places like that, so it all has to be cleaned off. But then a final hand polish with our favourite polishing compound, Mothers.
Oh, I should include a picture of that.
There's no shine like Mothers, apparently.
That's what they say, yeah. And I would agree. In terms of cleaning out soap from thread holes and things on outer covers particularly, what I've found works well in recent years is we've got some nice drill-mounted wire bottle brushes, which one of those in a cordless drill or on a post drill or whatever, run through all of those. That's nice, and it gives a nice little bit of a shine around all of those, so that's nice to do as well. Speaking of hand polishing, but first, quick warning, if you've got a late C range Triumph, those outer covers are over and above. Why is this, do you think?
What?
They're particularly nasty and porous.
Oh, in fact, I was going to mention that a bit earlier, but I'll mention it now as you ask.
Go ahead.
The late C range particularly, the 500 unit twins, a lot of the outer covers, particularly timing cover and primary cover, have an enormous porosity. Now, if you're polishing them as you would a decent piece of aluminium, you'll end up with all sorts of freckles. And as you polish these areas of porosity, don't assume it's corrosion and take more and more material off, hoping that eventually these pinholes will disappear. And if you polish them conventionally, you'll just end up stretching those pin marks into a whole streak. So at some point you realise the more you're polishing, the worse it's beginning to look. Now, the technique I developed for that is, once you recognise what you're up against, and this usually is when you've transitioned from grit and you're now on soap and you're stretching this porosity and it's looking awful, stop at that point and run over the whole thing with an orbital sander with something like 180 grit to actually resurface and bring all the surface level again, so you can have another go. And then the trick is to not leave the mop on one area too long. You're literally rapidly moving the cases and rapidly changing direction as well, so that you tend to just polish the surface you've now created rather than dig into the pinholes. And actually, they can be made look really quite respectable, but they're nasty cases to start with.
I think that's the way we're talking about this is the right direction to approach it from. We're talking a lot about scratches and scratch removal and abrasion. That's the way to think of polishing. You're not making it shiny, that's the result, but you are removing scratches.
Well,
first and
what
foremost.
You're actually doing is making the scratches finer and finer and finer.
Yes, quite right. which is that was a big thing that changed my thinking in terms of machine polishing. But we touched on hand polishing there, and speaking about abrasion, we generally do this with con rods and pistons. We use a form of polishing that doesn't use any kind of soap or anything of that nature at all, don't we?
Micromesh.
Go on.
It is fabulously expensive. They call it cushioned abrasives, and it's made in America. And one of the things it was used for in the Royal Air Force was to where you used to see aircraft belonging to the Queen's flight. Large parts of the fuselage were raw aluminium, highly polished, and it was actually various grits of micromesh that were used to achieve that. Also, as I understand it, it's used for repairing scratches and so forth in perspex cockpit screens and windows. We originally discovered it by a donation of small amounts of this that we could try from somebody who worked with it within the RAF. So we discovered just what brilliant stuff it was, and then had to set about actually buying some. And it is ferociously priced because it's a unique product. It's only made, as far as I know, by the one company in the States. And I can't remember, you might remember better than I, what part of the States it is.
I'll Google it. I don't know. No, I don't recall.
Anyway, it's called Micromesh Cushioned Abrasives. And when we were – you can buy it actually comes – the one the stuff that we use is a 6-inch wide 50-foot roll. So, you know, and given that it's expensive stuff, you can see in some grades we're paying 200 quid a roll for it. But a roll lasts a long time. But then you've got to find another roll. Now, there's lots of people on eBay selling cut-up lengths of it. So you get a 6-inch by 10-inch sheet and a pack of various different grits. Well, that's no bloody use to us at all.
That's probably a nice little earner, though. We should have thought of that.
Yeah. I managed to track the company down, and unfortunately, having my good buddy Jack as a USA contact, whilst I was Skyping him one day, for the grits I couldn't get resold in the UK, he phoned the factory direct.
Yeah, I think we talked about it at the time. It's worth telling again.
And this lovely young woman on the other end, she said, "Well, I'll just check whether I've got that in stock." But
we were a bit timid, really, because we didn't need a lot of it. There's Jack going, we only need a roll. We don't need a whole shipment of it. And when I said we talked about this previously, I meant the episode he was on 10?
Yeah.
From memory? I don't know.
I think she came back and said, "No, we don't have it on the shelf. We'll have to manufacture some for you." And I think it was that point Jack said, "We only need a rock." Because he thought he was going to get in deeper than he wanted to. She said, we can produce just a roll. And she said, "Because that's what we do."
very useful stuff, though. And as you've seen from the pictures, if you're looking, very good for cleaning up pistons and com rods. You do have to work through quite a series of them. We usually go from 180 to 1800 to 3200 to 6000 and then finish off with 12,000. And it's funny, the really fine stuff, you'd hardly think there was any abrasion.
Looks like untreated leather, doesn't it?
Yes, that's probably... That's probably not
it. There was any abrasion at all, which speaks to my point about what you're actually doing is making the scratches finer and finer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the one last area of refinishing we have to talk about is something that we don't have too much involvement with, actually, because as Ray pointed out, we have a specialist in the village here. I think there's a couple of specialists, actually, and that is chrome plating. What can you tell us about chrome plating?
Well, again, Vehicle and General Polishers and Platers are our local plating works. My personal view is they are amongst the best out there. I did try another firm at one time who shall remain nameless and have regretted it to this day. Now, one little interesting point is that had we not voted to come out of the European Union for the good it's done us, within 6 months of that vote, our local polishing works would have by law ceased trading. As it is, At that time, their workload instantly doubled. Because if that had happened and they closed down, bearing in mind this is all with reference to a European-wide ban on decorative chrome plating, because as I understand it, some of the products can be carcinogenic, which is not a risk for the person who gets the chrome plating done. It's a risk for the operator, and their safety, health and safety protocols more than address that problem. But good old European Union, if they want to ban something, they'll do it. So their workload doubled overnight because, a lot of the plating works that would have dealt with European stuff, now it's all coming to the UK because we're the last man standing. Failing that, it would have been India or America or somewhere that all the plating would have had to go to. So,
well, as I understand, there is some different process that is being used in European countries, but I understand the results are not a good. Did I read somewhere give it an interesting sort of blue-looking finish?
Yeah, sure I mean, that's right. The point was there are alternatives. It's not as good. It's not as attractive. And it would have cost many thousands of pounds to
£30,000, I think they said it would have cost.
Something like that to re-equip the local works.
Not wishing to nail our colours to the mast politically wise or other opinions.
I think we just did. But,
well, my opinion is largely the same as yours. It's one of the things we don't ever done a disagreement on. But, we're a broad church here. We're all friends here.
But what you've got to appreciate, obviously, with chrome plating is that it's a very invasive process. And the very very first thing that has to happen to something that was previously chrome-plated and is now chrome-plated and rusty is that it has to get stuck in an acid bath, which indiscriminately removes steel, chrome, nickel, whatever. And the hope is that by the time that process is done, that you've got enough left to polish to get a perfect finish for then applying, first of all, nickel and then chrome-plating. By and large, I would say it's a bit of a judgment call where new stuff is available as to whether you would buy new or have replated. And I would say if you can buy a new product that is nicely chrome plated where it's available, that may be preferable. Because obviously, by the time if you're just plating something that's been newly manufactured, you haven't got to do a tremendous amount of polishing and processing to be able to get it to the point where it will chrome plate nicely. Whereas if you're refurbishing an old item, it may be way more expensive to refurbish than to buy a new item, and you may get deeper in than you think and end up at the end of the day with somebody that's been re-chrome plated that really doesn't look that good. The other thing which did occur to me, and you see it often at classic car shows, because a lot of the, like for example, rear lamp surrounds on, sort of 70s, 60s and 70s, and to some extent 80s cars, are chrome die-cast. Now, one of the things about die-cast and one of the things about the acid stripping is if you've got a die-cast rear lamp surround that is pitted and the chrome's compromised cosmetically, in indiscriminately shoving the thing in an acid bath to get rid of the original chrome, it actually eats away at the rusted pits faster than it does the chrome. So you end up with some real tragedies of re-chromed items in this regard. And I did just think when we were conducting the experiment on those fork sliders, that would be a perfect workaround for people with that type of component.
Yes.
Just a thought.
Yeah. There are, of course, situations where it's worth having something chrome plated. I was going to talk about exhaust pipes, how, you can buy new exhaust pipes in. I mean, actually, in recent years,
the fit's a lot better.
Yeah.
The fit's way better than it ever used to be, most cases.
I mean, we've had situations where people have walked through the door and talked about a project they're working on, and they said, I bought some new exhaust pipes for it, but they didn't fit.
Well, there was a...
It was just like, yeah, you got to make them fit.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain people who have been so-called specialists, and I'm not even going to hint who this is, and I'm not even fully sure whether they're still in business, but I know people have tried to sue them and not managed to achieve it. But this particular company It used to be pretty standard that if you'd ever tried to restore a bike and ever bought new downpipes from this particular firm, those downpipes were still sitting on the shelf in your shed long after the project had been finished.
It is worth pointing out that somebody we are happy to mention is Hitchcock's Motorcycles, who do parts for Royal Enfield. I don't know if they still do, but they did have a disclaimer on their website where they were advertising exhaust pipes. Is yes, every set of pipes and silencers that are manufactured are going to be subtly different, but the same applies for the motorcycles to which they are being bolted, and they've got picture comparisons of the same set of pipes being offered up to two or three different vehicles. So not slagging off anybody who produces exhausts, but that's something.
And back in the day, Toga, who I think are still around, were one of the few that actually, you know, mass manufactured downpipes that actually had a jig consisting of a frame and a you know, empty but cosmetically complete engine where you could physically fit, before you chrome plated it, the pipe onto this jig to prove it would be a fit. And they were one of the first,
Not a bad idea. Final thing to mention in terms of chrome plating, as we are particular fans of A65s, there is something on that that you need to be careful about re-chrome plating, is there not, Raymond?
Oh, remind me?
Fuel tanks.
Oh, well, yeah. Yes, it's... what in particular are you...
A50, fuel tanks are chrome plated, and if the chrome's nasty, you think, I want to have that re-chrome plated.
Oh, well, yeah, sorry, I've right.
Actually been a long while since we've been presented with one.
Yeah,
in this
The fact of the matter is that if your BSA predominantly had chrome tanks, if your BSA fuel tank needs re-chroming, it better not have been replated before, because as I referenced earlier about the invasive nature of the actual stripping process before you get to polish it, you can pretty much guarantee that a BSA tank will only replate once. You can occasionally get away with doing it the second time, and there's various workarounds, but is what is more usual, by the time you take the corrosion that's gone on the inside and the damage and the removal of material from the outside through the stripping process, if you tried to do it the second time, you end up with something that's comparable with lace curtains. We actually got away with, I was actually tasked, and in fact, at least one picture of it's on the website, quite a late aerial square 4, and it had been previously restored, actually not that massively long ago, relatively speaking, but it had not been, there'd been an issue with the adhesion of the chrome to the tank, and you could literally have peeled it off in strips and posted it back to the plating works. It was awful. And given that that tank had already been restored, fortunately, as it turned out, Ariel in that period were using way thicker gauge material, and we actually did just about get away with replating for the second time.
Interesting. I don't think I've heard that story.
Okay.
So that's basically everything we're going to talk about today. Is it worth just to finish off describing your suggestion to me, what you've got planned for the next episode of the podcast, well, when we get around to that?
We've
got it penciled in for 2023.
we've alluded to a particular current project of mine, which, you know, we get even less time for those than we do podcasts as it goes. But I'm making a particular push because I want to be shaking it down this summer to get it, you know, completely sorted by the end of the year, is my single seater project. Now, I've described it variously as the last A65 new build ever, which is not entirely true. I think I've also described it as my retirement present to myself.
But that's probably not true either.
But that's assuming I ever get to retire. To be fair, I have used an awful lot of new old stock. I see those letters NOS on an eBay posting, and I get seduced. So, I mean, anyway. Suffice it to say that at some point, not too soon, we've got far enough along the build you know, to have essentially the final set of components all in place. And it would be nice to do a podcast just to give you the rundown of what we've done, what we've used, and why we've done what we've done to this project. It started life reputing to be a BSA Spitfire, and given that it will be a bit of a Marmite bike, there will be lovers and haters. I don't want anybody to think that I've destroyed a perfectly good original Lightning to achieve what I've achieved. As I said to the previous owner when he sold me the bike, when he told me it was a Spitfire, I said, well, I can see no evidence of that. One may have flown over it at some point.
There we go. I wonder who will be the Prime Minister when we get round to recording that. Then again, if we record it next week, though.
Still knows? A question mark.
Anyway, that's all from us. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you get that kind of thing. Give us a like or a comment or a review or whatever. We'll read it out. If you're on any forums, do share that with your online community. You can send us an email, rjandpodcast@gmail.com, or check out the website, rjandclassic.com.